This episode of Yes But Why podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
What was the first time in your life that you recognized that you wanted to do performance? Like, you know, it can be when you're a little kid or the first play that you did, or heck, it could be when you turned 20 and someone was like, have you heard about improv? So
yes, it was like you said, I was 20 exactly, and I saw an improv play, and I said, I was already starting doing theater, like community theater, with some friends, but only because we were bored and we wanted to play in a certain frame, different than playing by ourselves. And we got to this community college or school, I don't know the name in English, afternoon class with a lot of just 50 to 60 year old ladies, me and my best friend. So we started playing and doing like improvisations to get to the text or to a certain play. And then eventually I saw an improv play and I convinced that same friend to do it, to just let's copy this and let's start doing it. They always say that when I was a kid, I was kind of a clown, and like many kids like to be in the spotlight and the center of attention. And then adolescence and school does their thing and you stop doing that because you feel awkward or you feel ashamed of that.
Yep.
But fortunately, at 19, 20, I got this second shot, and it was crazy because it wasn't comfortable at all. But eventually got more and more comfortable and more fun. And well, I'm here after that decision.
So when you mention the class with the 50 and 60 year old women, was that your community theater class?
Yes.
That you were doing plays, or was that the improv class?
No, it was the community theater.
Oh.
It was like this old school theater teacher drama and alcohol and violence and sex. That was all the
all the plays.
The usual topics.
Yeah.
Playing with 20 no, 15 women of my mother's age and two 20-year-old guys. It was very fun.
I bet they loved you.
Yeah.
And two 20-year-old guys. That's so fun. Where was it that you saw that first improv show that inspired you to do it?
It was in Buenos Aires, where I used to live. And it was in a very nice traditional theater in Corrientes Avenue, which is the Broadway from Buenos Aires, which all the theaters are there. And it was an improvisation match. It was the French format, competition French format, like similar to theater sports. My friend heard about that and said, hey, there's a play in which you can take part of. Maybe they ask you things so you can jump there upstage and just play. And I said, yes, let's do it. And after we saw the show, I said, okay, this is it. This is it. I don't want to memorize anything again. I want to do this.
That's so funny. People always say that. They're like,
yeah,
I don't
lazy.
Want to memorize.
Improvisers are lazy actors.
No, I'm like working so hard against that. I'm like, no, don't be lazy. Even improvisers work hard.
But yeah, exactly. That's that's a trick, is that you get into this because you don't want to learn a text, and then it's so much more effort because you get to write it, you get to direct it, and actually play it. So
yeah.
No, I want to go. If I would be lazy, I would go back to to scripted theater.
You're right. It's like all the jobs all at once right now.
Exactly.
As opposed to
nobody tells you that on the first day of improv class.
Yeah. I hope this isn't the first episode that my students are listening to. Don't get scared. I teach level one, so I ease them into it pretty slow.
Yeah, that eventually, so they know what to expect.
Yeah. First thing, I'm like, just talk. Words out of your mouth. You're great. Oh, man. That's so fun. So this first improv show you saw, you mentioned it was short form games, so it was more fast and fun, and you said a lot of interaction with the audience. Was that the style that you guys ended up doing when you and your friend did it on your own? Did you read books about it, or did you just take a class with the theater in Buenos Aires and then take it from there?
It was very hard that time to find anything to read or to watch. That this was 2000.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, year 2000. No YouTube, barely. I think we found one text in Spanish from the LNI, which is the Ligue Nationale d'Improvisation de Quebec, which are the people that invented MATCH, this competition format. So that was our only inspiration. Then eventually we found out about Keith Johnston's book, Impro, but that was a couple of years after. What we did was copying what we saw and play amongst us in our rehearsals, in our classes. We convinced our teacher to try it, and then we found this small basement in a bar that would allow us to play for free every Friday. So we started doing it with our friends, and basically we were just copying and say, okay, this is how it might be, should be, supposed to be. And then I found out, Googling, I found out there was this group and they were teaching classes, and I signed up for my first improv class in March 2003. So it was like 3 years of just playing without knowing what we were doing.
That's so fascinating to me. I find the idea of that, I've heard so many other people from everywhere all across the world tell me a similar story, that they saw a show and then just winged it with their friends. They're like, let's pretend we know what we're doing, because they're making it up so we can make it up, right? And just the sheer bravery of that, just like the idea of like, yeah, let's try it, is so amazing. Like, I come from such a sort of sheltered environment. All of my improv has been so structured in schools and curriculum and groups of people that were like, this is how it's done. I never, you know, like this idea of just being like, I guess this is what we should do, which is fun and great. Yep. And also like really like the more I talk to
and again,
people
back
about
then,
improv,
there were
like,
many
oh.
options. There were like two or three places in Buenos Aires where you could study, and they were like very similar, because improv landed in Argentina in 1988.
Yeah.
And it was this format, this particular format of competition of MATCH, that it was there, and it was just different ways of looking at it as a show or more as a competition, and that's it. And so until 2005 or 2006, that other people started saying, hey, we can do this or we can do that. We didn't know there was another way. So basically it's people playing in a sports-like show, which we love. I particularly love sports. So it was the perfect combination of theater and sports for me, because I really, really enjoyed competition and I took it seriously. And I always knew that the main goal was to do a great show. But if I can actually win the game, win the championship, I will be happier. And I will be very angry and sad when I lost a game, as much as when it was a lousy show. It's like, okay, it was great. People loved it, but we could have done better. Or people liked it and I loved the show, but damn, we lost. It was fun because it was, again, it was the only form we knew and we didn't know. And eventually when the doors opened and the ceiling went up, it was like, oh, there are so many other things we can do with this technique.
It's great until that, that you
until
had
then,
3 years.
Until then, we only knew it was like a show. We didn't know how much was behind it.
Or I guess how much could be behind it. Though, again, just the idea that you guys did it on your own, and it like renews my faith in the idea of improv as this, like, I talk about it almost like it's religion. I know that's a lot. But just because it's so, like, it helps people, it's open to people, and also it's, like, accessible. And people seek it out even when it's not accessible. Like, like the fact that you guys did this on your own, it's like that was inside of you. That was something that you needed to express. And I love that even though there wasn't necessarily a person pointing you, do this, do that, you just found it. Did you guys make up games, more games than, so you had a few that you saw in the shows that were going on, but did you make a few up?
Basically, it was like the difference between theater sports and match is that we didn't play these theater sports games, like spoiling games, but it was a genre, movie or literally or TV, amount of players, amount of time, and whether it was the two teams separate or the two teams at the same time. So we actually knew about games way after. It was just, okay, as a horror movie or as a Western movie or as a romantic movie. It was, that was the premises. And so, yes, what we did was, okay, what other genres do we know or are specific or can we invent? But the idea of, playing any other typical theater sport game was unknown to us.
So then when you guys found Keith Johnstone, it must have felt perfect. It seems quite aligned with what he was talking about, a lot of the genre stuff.
Yes, and what changed was that, okay, that it was part of the idea of the more we can read, the more we can know and understand that this is just a tool, and what you do with it, it's infinite. That's when we thought, okay, we saw examples. My first example out of the box was in Spain in 2005. It was an international festival. We got invited to play this match tournament, and each company invited also had to present a show, a particular show, something that was not the match. And I saw a show from Impro Madrid, from Spain, that it was just two improvisers on stage telling a story with a camera so they can do all these monologues, and we could watch it on a screen. And then in another of the stage, they had a computer where they typed parts of the story so you can read it. And it was like, this was never in my mind. I thought that was it. And when I saw that, I look at Marcelo, was my partner by that time, we're doing improv together, and it was like, whoa, we can do more. And when we came back to Buenos Aires, we quit Match and started our own company. And it was like, yes, we want to keep investigating and diving into this and see what else can we do. And that's when we stopped doing Match and made our own format and started playing longer scenes and telling stories. And it was like, okay, this is what I like.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I really love that. What year was that festival you went? When?
Sorry?
What year was it?
2005.
Oh, wow. So you had just started, you are 5 years into doing improv, and this festival just really blew your mind. That's so wonderful that you came back, you created a company, a format, and just like got it going. Were you guys, did you start teaching classes at that point to other people to do your new format, or was it still shows, and where did you put those shows on?
We started we designed this idea. Then eventually, many years later, again, we knew it was something similar to Harald. We never knew who Harald was. We never knew that guy.
I don't think any of us know Harald.
It was magical. It was this idea of, okay, this kind of format or this structure or is similar to this has been played for a long time in a lot of places, and we never knew about it. And we developed, eventually we evolved to this format by our own. It was like, it makes sense. It's like, okay, maybe it's the natural evolution of an improviser's mind to try and figure out how to tell longer stories, to connect, to stop relying too much on the suggestions, but to really improvise. So we came up with this idea of three stories, based each of the stories in a word, and then a fourth story that combined or mixed the three realities into one. And it was very good. It was there were three of us, three improvisers actually, and a musician, and it was a very good show. And it was the dawn of the long form era in Buenos Aires. It was us and it was another group called Entre Parentheses, which means between parentheses, and they did an amazing long form in which they didn't ask for anything to the audience. They didn't ask for any suggestion. It was also groundbreaking, and we were like the first, the first generation of To Kill Our Parents, so in a Freudian way to speak, and risk and say, okay, what else can we do?
What was the name of your company? Spread.
Sorry?
What was the name of your company at this point?
Global Impro. Still.
It is still
my company, which we don't perform, but I'm still Global Impro. I still have faith that sometimes I will have my own cast in Madrid called Global Impro again.
You can. You can do whatever you want. Yeah. Especially eventually, if your friends are cool with you using the name.
Yeah, this is my email. So still it's info at globalimpro.com.
Yeah. You're still paying for the website, so it's yours. Yeah, I dig
exactly.
It. Yeah.
And the show was called Swing.
Oh.
And it was really nice. I always remember that show with very with much love, because it was really good and people liked it and we were doing something different. So I'm really proud of those years.
That's really wonderful. You said it was the dawn of long form improv in Buenos Aires. That's very, the idea that you are paying attention to that and that you're connected to that is really interesting. Do you notice the flow of things as you're living them, you know, like, cause some people don't see the big picture. Like the idea of even saying that is like, oh wow, you really see the journey of the whole community. Like that's really amazing.
Yes,
Do you see the big picture?
We started, what changed especially was how we communicate within the community itself. It was a very close structure in which every company had their own thing going and they didn't actually talk to each other. And the first thing we did is start talking to each other and say, hey, I'm trying this and you're trying this. Let's get together. And actually, when we met this other company, Entre Parentheses, the first thing we did after meeting was organizing a local festival, because there were a lot of other small groups that wanted to share and wanted to be seen and wanted to connect. And as we thought that the best thing we could do is to come together and play together, because it was completely opposite to the philosophy that was there. There was everybody just minding their own business and don't share because they will steal your things. And we evolved differently. We evolved to sharing. We evolved to let's play together. And people that were playing next to each other finally got to meet. Yeah. So in 2007, we organized the first open festival in Buenos Aires with six troops from Buenos Aires and two other cities nearby. And that was the beginning of this pandemonium of improvisers everywhere and sharing and inviting each other to to shows and classes and trainings and playing not only with your cast and or avoiding the group mentality of we are this, and every time we do a show we play with the same people. And it evolved to, okay, I like you, we are from different troops, but I have an idea of a show or a structure or a theme or whatever, and I want to improvise with you. So eventually we started losing our names as companies and started working with shows. Okay, this is like scripted theater, basically. We started working with projects and say, okay, in this project, I'm going to work with you and you. That's it. We do it. So that I think that was the key to how things evolved in Buenos Aires and the rest of Argentina and eventually to the rest of Latin America.
Wow, that's really amazing. I'm so glad that, you know, you guys brought the spirit of community to all the different theaters. I have definitely been part of a community where the theaters did not get along. One of the first theaters I was involved in, the guy who ran it just was kind of a meanie and didn't like anybody and was like, no, don't talk to them. So I was new. I didn't know. I was like, oh, okay, I want to talk to them. But, you know, just it's so crazy because as you're telling me this story, like that's when we started talking to each other. I was like, I feel like in Austin that happened like 2 years ago. Like it's not like recently. Mm-hmm. People were very separate and schools were like, this is what we do and this is what you do and don't talk to each other.
Yeah, but I think it's the natural evolution of the circles in improv. For me, I once developed this theory of improv comes to a certain community, usually from an outside source. Somebody says, hey, I found this in a festival or in a trip or whatever. And they form a group, a big group, and it's very successful. And then eventually artistic and personal differences, they split up. And that's stage two. They have two different groups with two different styles or philosophies. And then they start forming new improvisers. And then stage three is these students start to talk to each other and say, hey, our parents don't like each other. Why shouldn't we? And stage four is this new mind of working together. And this in this stage is where I think we get the most out of improv, when we just work with each other and we don't care where we studied, where we performed, we just share. And theory is proof in many, many communities. It keeps happening. It's natural. It's not good. It's not bad. It's what it is. But I'm usually waiting for the stage four moment. When I go to a city and they say, yeah, we are on this moment. I know you're in stage two. Wait for stage four. I promise it'll get better.
How sweet of you. Now I want you to do like a tour across America to go city to city and be like, you guys will be okay soon.
It will be a nice research project paid for a university or something like that.
Just it could be going
around the world.
You'd probably have to get a PhD in like psychology because you're like studying how communities work. But so that's so interesting. So you were like a major part of the improv scene in Buenos Aires. Are you now, do you have another job? Do you have a day job? Are you working during the day and doing improv at night? Or did you find a way to do theater and improv full time?
And right now, since when I was living in Buenos Aires, I used to also work as I never know how to say this without sounding creepy, as a child entertainer for birthdays.
Sure.
It makes sense.
I have a kid, so it's a lot easier to work. I'm like,
2-3 hours per day. And I got to steal a lot of things from kids because they are natural improvisers and clowns. So I had so much fun. And so that was awesome. What paid the rent. I was already playing in a couple of theaters and doing some touring, and especially in Latin America. And then 3 years ago, when I moved to Spain, moved to Madrid, and I finally said, okay, I don't have to do any other thing but improv and improv related things or acting related things. So my independence, 100% independence, came officially 3 years ago, basically because it's, I'm working the same that in Buenos Aires, but it's easier to live in Spain than in Argentina. So that helps that I can just focus on improv in general.
Yeah. When you moved to Madrid, did you move there for a job? Like, was there an improv theater you had connected with and they said, hey, we want you to work with us? Or were you have an adventure and then you happened to go to Madrid?
I knew a lot of people in Madrid because I came here a couple of times before touring in Europe. And I knew there would be opportunities, but nothing sure. So when I came, I just started talking to these people, and they offered me teaching in a school, and they offered me taking part of a cast in another group. And eventually, the good thing is when I came, the season was already started. So that first year, I was like the cover for everyone. If they needed a teacher, I was free. If they needed a cover for a show, I was free. So that first year, I had a lot of work. And one other thing that I usually do is I travel a lot. And now that I'm in Europe, everything is closer. Because when I used to live in Argentina, every time I was invited to a festival, I had to organize a tour around it to make it worth. And now I can go for a weekend to another country here because it's 2 hours.
Yeah, flight. Good old Ural. Yeah. Love that.
I just came from two festivals in Vienna and in Poland, and it was just 12 days. It's great. It.
That's so awesome. Oh, that's so great. And it really is like a major European connection for improv. Like the festivals are amazing. And so it's really great that you're really taking advantage of it and going around and enjoying all of the festivals you possibly can. I'm not going to lie, I'm very jealous, but in a nice way. This is so cool. I'm really excited about it. I also am excited about first of all, just to say, when you were an entertainer at children's parties, like that in and of itself is such a like extroverted thing to do. Like, people who are shy are not gonna try to entertain kids. Like, you're clearly a performer forever, and the fact that was your other job to make money, like, you're made for this. You're like all performer head to toe. I love it. And I love that how, like, you're talking about it was such like, oh yeah, that's just what you do. I'm like, every move you're telling me you've made is so brave. Like, people don't do this. People aren't like, I'm just gonna move to Madrid.
I was very conscious of my choices when I was just a teenager. I always knew that I would never work 8 hours per day, 5 hours, 5 days a week. That was not my thing. And I never had a job like that. So I always tried to have as much time for me possible. I don't need much money to live, and I'm not a consumer. So that helps. I sometimes I was broke and I didn't have money to pay for things, but I kept on my journey of do what you want to do, because otherwise if you have a job, I'm not saying a bad job, a good job with a good pay, and it's okay, it's not your thing, but it's a very good job, then you won't break that chain. You will be stuck there because it's not enough for you to rebel. And I knew that might happen. So, just keep. I had a lot of other crazy works before and during entertainer. And like giant puppets or puppeteer. Right. I worked for a summer in Argentina SeaWorld. I was up for any not structured formal job that people could offer.
I love it. Me too. I did the same thing. I was like, I am not going to do it. I have definitely worked a couple of 9-to-5s, but I go through this company that is a temporary agency. So you just get like, you know, you do like a week to cover somebody's vacation.
Yeah, you keep changing.
That's all that I can handle. 1 week. And I'm like, okay, bye everybody. And you're everybody's favorite person because you're new and exciting. Best. Yeah, I love that. That really just, I think that that's an important part of, you know, living this kind of thing is like you made a decision not to go down the road that could lead you to like a day job that was comfortable. So you would be afraid to leave it. And that is super smart because I feel like people, I'm always talking to people and they're like, well, I got to have this responsible thing. And it's like, no, adjust the rest of your life so that whatever job that you can find in the wacky world that you want to work in will pay for what you need. Like, I like the idea where you're like, I don't need that much money to live. Hopefully if you can budget well enough, most of us can live relatively cheaply, especially if you're working so hard towards a dream. And yay, so happy for you that it all sort of worked out that turns out it's like less money to live in Madrid. Awesome. I'm so happy. Now, other thing that you did that I wanted to give you a compliment on, was when you first moved to Madrid, you said you got involved with the theater, but it was too late to get you in as a teacher. So you just helped everybody else. Like, pro tip, anyone, everyone who's listening, the number one way to get a new crowd to love you is help them for a year. Like, just spend all your time helping them. The fact that you were always there to assist them must have just made everybody feel so much more at ease. Like, oh, he's here. He's got my back. He can take care of it.
Yeah.
Like that. Yes. And then you are everyone's favorite because, you know, you can help and you're always there. And it's like, who's here carrying this box? Who's here when I'm sick and I need a cover for my class? Like, you're saving the day every day. And that's such a good move. I'm sure you didn't do it selfishly. I'm sure you did it selflessly. But I'm just saying it's such a good move because it puts you in such a good position to be friends and to be known as a good person in the new community.
Yes, it was. It worked.
It worked. So now, what's the name of the theater that you work at in Madrid?
I work with a company called El Club de la Impro, and I also work and teach in another school called Impro Madrid. The guys I saw 14 years ago and blew my mind. Now I get to work with them now.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. The same people that make me wonder how much can we do with this are the ones I'm working with today. I'm teaching at their school and do some shows with them. I get to play in my favorite team.
That's awesome. So in this case, meeting the people that inspired you was not bad. They were great.
They were great. And it was one of the first that offered me a job as a teacher in their school because we share the same philosophy, and it was great. Great. Awesome. Of course, I learned it from you. So it's great that I can be part of that same philosophy and same team.
Did you tell them?
Yes, I wrote a book about improv and football and soccer, and on there that I wrote that in the book that it was for me, it was like playing for Barcelona. I'm a Barcelona fan here in Spain, so it was like, you are the team where a lot of other players would like to play, and I'm here, so it was like, this is for you. It was very cool.
That's great. That's so awesome. And what a fun way. You're like, oh, you read my book. I like it. Man, that's so awesome. Tell me now then, what's your experience day to day now? Are you teaching classes? Are you coaching troops? How much do you perform?
Well, this year now starting, I'm teaching once a week at Impro Madrid, and I have another class in another school, another weekly class. And now I will be coaching a company also from Madrid. They asked for my help just a couple months ago. So we're starting next Friday, actually. They need a director for a specific show they are developing. So I'm very excited about that because I really like directing. And on next Friday, we'll start in a new season of a show. It's called Impro Magia, which is how it sounds, Impro and Magic, which is very cool. And we will be playing every Friday for the next 3 months. And that's basically it.
That's a lot.
I also have a duo show with another improviser that he's not from Madrid. He's from Mallorca. And so we try to synchronize our calendars and try to find a city where we can play. So the idea is to have as many chances we can to show this new format. And basically, yes, this is what I expect for the next 3 months. Then you never know, because Madrid keeps changing and the season keeps changing, and we're improvisers and everything changes and we adapt. That's a good thing. And usually once a month or once every 2 months, I travel somewhere else to play or teach in a festival or just visiting. So that's also part of my monthly or yearly structure, is to travel as much as I can, because I still have that curiousness and want to meet more people and more ways of doing it and share my ideas and find new ideas and challenge people, be challenged by them, and return a better improviser. That's my goal. Every time I go to a festival, it's not that common, but when it happens, it's amazing to return home better than you left. That's an amazing feeling.
Yeah, especially when there's so many students too that get to soak up what you just experienced. As soon as you get home, you're like, guys, guess what I learned? Let me tell you all about it.
Yeah,
and then everybody's better.
Yeah, we have a Tuesday show that there's like, it's not a company, it's not a troupe, but we are 15 improvisers in a WhatsApp group that every Tuesday we play in a very underground place that's packed with 70, 80 people every Tuesday. And the idea is to experiment. And I have an idea, or I saw this, or I saw a movie, or I read a book, or I went to a festival and saw this format. I want to try it. So basically we try new things every Tuesday. And it's amazing because those improvisers are some of the best improvisers, most experienced improvisers in town. And you get to play with these people every week and new stuff. So we don't get too comfortable.
Yeah, wow. That sounds like a really fun show. All the experimental stuff you guys get to do. Try this out, see how it works. That's a super fun situation there. Man, so you seem to be full speed ahead all the time. You've got always working. You've always got new ideas. You're bringing communities together. Has there ever been a time that you've, hit a wall or felt like you had no more creative juices flowing in you? And if you did, how do you generally get out of that kind of slump?
Mm. It happened to me not because of the improv technique, but the improv community. When I was living in Buenos Aires, I got tired of pulling the car. It's like, I'm so tired of producing, of directing, or doing and not seeing the results. Partially because of the community itself. A lot has to do with the economical, political situation in Latin America that's so unexpected and so unstable. I was like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. Not the going on stage or teaching, but organizing things is very hard, very complicated everywhere. Yeah. And when the environment doesn't help, it's very, how you say, when you don't want to do it anymore, like it's overwhelming, basically.
Yeah, I think of disheartening, like making you sad. Yeah.
So a little bit of that. Or a lot of that changed when I moved to Madrid, because I thought things were easier. But I think it has to do with how you get used to. But now it's the third year I'm living here, and I'm already complaining about how people don't think more than 2 or 3 months ahead. But then before this, 2 months or 3 months ahead was a lot of time for me. Now it's not. Now I think I can plan for 6 months, or when I work with people from other countries, like Germany, for instance, they book you shows and trips and workshops with 5 or 6 months ahead. It's crazy, but it's also nice. And for instance, now there's Gael, Laura, from different.
Oh yeah, you going to Bali?
Sorry, just 1 second. It was an incoming call.
I hear you. It happened to me last.
And they are traveling the world, and they want to do some shows and workshops here.
Wait, hold on. Do me a favor. Since the phone call came through, I'll have to cut it. So, can you tell me about Laura and Gael again?
Yeah, Laura and Gael. They are a couple of improvisers. She's from the Netherlands, Laura Dornerbert, she's amazing, and he's Gael Perry from France. They got together and they got married and they started a world tour. One of the cities they're hitting is Madrid, and of course they have this, especially Laura from Netherlands, they organize things with a lot of time. And I said, no, this doesn't work here in Madrid. I need 2 weeks tops. People won't commit to anything earlier than that. So that's how the cultural differences within Europe are also very important.
Do you think that, do you guys have like a regular schedule each year? Meaning like you have the same festival every year on the same time of year? There's like certain big events that repeat each year, or is it different all the time?
No, Madrid doesn't have like a very close structure in terms of a season. We don't have a big festival. I'm thinking right now when you ask the question, but no, we don't have anything that will say, okay, I know that every October we have this or we have that.
Because I feel like that's what helps here.
To have it, but it's very complicated.
Oh, totally. I mean, I would never want to run a festival, and believe me, I would never suggest to you to do that. That is the extra special nightmare of organizing.
Somebody else to do it, and I would go. I would attend, but no, not me.
Yeah, that's right. Other Madrid listeners, start a festival. So much fun. You should do it. We'll come. We will support you. But yeah, it's a tough thing. The reason why I asked is in Austin, there's a lot of schools, and so we're not always around each other or connected, but there's a handful of festivals that happen during the year that tend to kind of bring everybody together. It's like, oh, right, it's this again. Hey, everyone, what's up? You know, that kind of thing. Or like certain every year they do this same party, you know, kind of thing for the whole community.
There is something. There's not like a fixed date. It's once in a while that Omar Galvan is another improviser that travels the world a lot. He organizes a marathon. And this year, now the first one is this Saturday, actually. Starting 10:30 p.m. ending 5:30 or 6, something like that a.m. And it's like an epic night when people, especially from Madrid, and people also travel from other cities to Madrid just to spend the night improvising and sharing and drinking. And it's a pretty cool thing, but it's not something we have it every year, maybe twice a year, but we don't know when. It's like, okay, maybe next month, and Omar organizes it. So yeah, that would do.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be so interesting, even like we were talking about earlier, that people who take improv classes often take it because they don't want to memorize lines. I think there's also a level of like, you know, I don't want to commit to anything. You know, you're like, you got to commit a little. But, you know, that can be really hard as far as like creating, you know, long-term schedules or trying to plan far out. I am also in the camp that definitely plans very far out. So I'm like planning next summer now. I'm like, yeah, then, you know, but that's just because it makes it easier financially to plan it out. But yeah. But like when you have, so you've mentioned a few of the projects that you're working on right now. I'm going to try to say this without using an idiom. I say, what is your jam? But what I mean is, like, what, when you're teaching, when you're performing right now, all of us, I'm a teacher too, and so I teach a lot of the same things over and over. Each time I teach them with a new class, they get it flavored a little different by me based on whatever thing I'm thinking of. Like sometimes I teach it and I'm super focused on emotional choices. And then so I'm always like, deep emotions. But sometimes I'm like, no, we're going to be cold and structured to understand, you know, what's the thing right now that's your teaching jam?
Yes. Last year it was how we talked and how many words we say and how little things we actually end up saying, how much we talk and how little we say. That's how I can put it.
Yeah.
Because I love silences and I love words. And because I love words, I don't want to listen to you talking all the time because you are going to miss all the good words. And then now I have the same thing with space, with movement. Okay, great. Don't move too much, and if you do, move consciously. So I'm working a lot with stage design and the idea of what are your position and when do you start a scene? Where do you start a scene? Usually look at any improv scene from everywhere, and you will find two people negotiating in the center of the stage. That was 90% of all improv scenes start like that, because that's what we do. We just meet in the middle and negotiate. And what I want is to make bold choices and say, okay, we're going to do the same, but I will start upstage left or downstage right or whatever, and then try to make that conscious choice. And if I move wisely and say, okay, if I move, it's because my director told me I should move, not because I don't know what to do and I move. Because it's the same with words. If you don't know what to say, just maybe you should shut up. Maybe you should stay silent.
Yeah.
And eventually when that phrase appears, then it will be much stronger. And it's the same with movements. If you just stand still, consciously still, not dead on stage, but still, and the other person is working around you, then when you move, everything changes. So it has a lot to do with viewpoints and how we react to speed, to rhythm, to break the structure. So that's what's on my mind now, and it crosses everything I say. It's like everything I told you, everything I teach you has to do with also conscience. Because improv is kind of a trance, but the idea is that eventually we can control part of that trance. We're still in the hands of our unconsciousness, and it's amazing, but the director has to be with the cold mind and say, okay, now go do it or not hold it. And the director part is one of my favorites, and I want people to start directing themselves more.
Yeah, that's awesome. Cool. That's a really great, like, idea to be focused on for your classes. I hope that you have a wonderful semester of classes that you can really sink your teeth into, and your students will come out much better and more excited for it. That's so great. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to share your experiences and your journey with the audience.
Well, my pleasure. And thank you for thinking about me. And so glad to be part of this improv podcast community, so more people can listen to what I have to say, not because it's me, but because it's somebody from another circle. Which is one of my first main concerns, that people would know what's happening outside their cities, their communities, and it's great.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.